Hey everyone, welcome to This Lesbian Ship is Intense. I'm Katie.
And I'm V.
Today, we are going to be talking to you about the Fear Street Trilogy. It's been out a little bit now on Netflix, but it seems to be one of the more popular sapphic
happenings.
Happenings. Contents right now, so we figured we'd talk about it.
Yeah, I could not escape Fear Street on my timeline at all because you and I discussed a little bit like what we wanted to do next, and surprisingly, I'm pretty sure I was the one who pushed for this, even though I didn't want to watch it.
Yeah, I wasn't even. I watched it. I liked it. I knew I was gonna like it, but I wasn't like pushing for it because I know V doesn't like horror. So what's going on there?
I just knew that like people really liked it, and I don't know that it's FOMO so much as like. I mean, I guess maybe that's what it is. It's just like I couldn't not watch it. I was like, everyone won't shut up about this. Like, I need to fucking watch it.
And now that makes two horror things that you didn't want to watch that we're talking about on the podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I don't regret it. Just, you know, if it wasn't for the pressure on my timeline, I definitely would not have watched this.
And I like horror, and I've always liked horror. But when I was watching this, I started thinking a lot about horror tropes and themes and a lot of stuff that you see in horror, and I was like surprised that I knew so much about it. Mm-hmm. But then I like started really thinking about it, and horror has been like basically with me since a part of my childhood. Like, my older sister is a horror buff and loves horror, so like she would be babysitting me when I was a child and be watching like I Know What You Did Last Summer, you know what I mean? So like I've watched
Because, like, I grew up watching horror as a kid because my cousin really loved it. And we were, like, joined at the hip. But I hate it because it terrified me.
We're going to talk through all three movies. Most of it is going to be on 1994 and 1666 because that's where most of the stuff happens. So that's just how it goes with us. And we might talk about some things generally with all the movies, but our focus is mostly going to be on the gay of it all.
Yeah, no surprise here that that's what we would focus on. So yeah, we're going to go ahead and give you some synopses of the three movies just to kind of like, I'm assuming y'all have watched it, but it seems like a good practice. So let's start out with 1994. Shadyside and Sunnyvale seem like rival towns, but it's more than just that. We learned that the murder spree by Ryan Torres in the intro of the movie is not an isolated incident. We meet the main character, Dina's younger brother, Josh, and we learn that Shadyside apparently is a hotbed for serial killers. Her brother's kind of like into conspiracy theories slash trying to figure out like why this is happening, and he knows a lot about Sarah Fear, who he thinks is behind the psychotic break, you know, for Ryan. And he thinks that that's the reason all these other serial killers have happened, too. Dina is less interested because she's still struggling with her breakup from Sam. They have to go to this memorial service where she is confronted with her ex and the fact that she's with this someone else. And it's a guy. His name is Peter, who appears to be an insensitive homophobic asshole and taunts Dina, which results in a car crash. And our story really begins. Sam has a flash of images before her eyes, and what she doesn't know is that she's triggered a series of events that will lead to many more deaths. The killers of Shadyside Past are out for murder, but not just anybody, as Dina and company realize. They're specifically after Sam. But even though Dina is, you know, she says she's mad at Sam, she can't sacrifice her, even though her friends suggest it. So she finds a loophole. Dina can live, she just has to die first. We think the movie could end with Sam and Dina, they're being cute in bed, but suddenly Sam is no longer acting like herself, and she has thrust a knife into Dina's abdomen, which takes us to movie 1978.
So, in 94, we learned that the gang found out that there was one survivor from the Nightwing massacre, C. Berman. they pay her a visit with Sam tied up in the trunk of the car and tie her to a radiator, as one does, to get the full story from C. Berman. So she jumps back to a time when she was at camp. And there was a big rivalry between Shadyside and Sunnyvale, even then. We find out that a character named Ziggy gets into a lot of trouble, which has resulted in crazy fucking Sheila trying to burn her and tie her up to the hanging tree. We also meet Nurse Mary Lane, the mother of Ruby Lane, who seems to have a connection with Ziggy. However, something is off when she attempts to kill Tommy, sweet virgin Tommy. Ziggy's sister Cindy is so distraught at this, but she thinks she was just on drugs, which often happens in horror movies. So we're also introduced to her ex-friend, now enemy, Alice, Alice's boyfriend, Jeremy, and Cindy, Tommy, Alice, and Jeremy investigate what's going on with Nurse Lane until Tommy has turned and tries to kill everybody. After he kills Jeremy, Cindy and Alice run. They get trapped in a bunker. They start investigating what could be going on and looking more into the mystery of Sarah Fear. As everyone tries to evade the murderer, we see a relation form between Nick Good, Sheriff Good in the first movie, and Ziggy. Then we have Cindy and Ziggy reuniting and trying to put their history behind them and come together to survive this and reunite the hand of Sarah Fear with her body to end the curse. And just as we think they're about to do this, the body is missing, the killers are coming for them, and Ziggy and Cindy are both killed. However, Ziggy makes a miraculous recovery thanks to Nick's CPR, and we jump back to 1994, where adult Ziggy informs the kids that this curse will never end, except our hero Dina and Josh know where the body is, and Ziggy knows where the hand is. So Dina is successful in reuniting Sarah Fear's hand with her body. But this time, she's transported back to where it all started in 1966.
1666. So Dina is now in the body of Sarah Fear, who seems to be a normal teenager, like, you know, what's normal back then, in the settlement of Union. We see so many familiar faces showing us the ancestry of the present-day citizens of Sunnyvale and Shadyside. Of note are Thomas, the guy who sees the darkness in Sarah, Solomon Good, who lives on the outskirts of town and is a failing farmer, and Hannah, who seems to be Sam's ancestor. Similar to present-day descendants, Sarah and Hannah seem to have a relationship with each other, and after a night of partying 1666 style, it's clear that not all is okay in Union. Of course, this must mean that the devil has come. So Sarah and Hannah are named as witches. Sarah seeks safety at Solomon's home, but she uncovers the devil stone and proof that it's Solomon Good who has invited the devil to Union for his own profit. So, of course, he does what any man would do and goes ahead and sacrifices her, even though he says he loves her, so that he can go ahead and be safe. Sarah, in turn, sacrifices herself for Hannah's safety, promising to curse him forever. She's hung. She dies. Handless. This takes us back to present day, where Dina now knows the truth of the Good successful lineage. Dina and company set up a plan to kill Nick Good and end the witch's curse slash his pact with the devil in order to release Sam from her possession. And it seems like the movie ends with Sam and Dina finally having their cheeseburger date, but we get a little clip of the devil journal being snatched. So we'll see what happens. But at least these gays get their happy ending for now.
Before we jump into movie by movie, I guess I want to talk about some, like, general thoughts on the trilogy as a whole. So this was kind of a first time for something in how these movies were released, with all three movies being filmed back to back and designed, shot, written to be released back to back week after week.
I didn't even think about that.
It's almost like a movie mini series, I guess. It feels like a hybrid between a typical movie trilogy and a TV mini series in a way. So I feel like the movies were told intentionally different than you would typically tell the story of a movie. So what are your thoughts about, like, the trilogy as a whole and how that came to be with how you received it.
I'm more of a book person than a movie person. And so I really do enjoy movies that are series because I like getting like a rich foundation and then like uncovering more to it if it's done well. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would, honestly. And I really enjoyed kind of going back in time and seeing the history and how it affected present day.
What I really liked about it is I think it gave them a lot more freedom in how they decided to tell the story, because typically I think, and this is my own personal opinion, that in terms of like franchises that have a set number of movies, the first one is usually the strongest because it creates the world and that's what creates your investment in it. But because of how they told the story, they kind of built the lore up and then gave you a big payoff of the lore at the very end instead of it being so front heavy. I think it makes the trilogy kind of keep getting better as it goes.
I would say the 1666 was my favorite. Like, I mean, we'll get into it a little bit more, but like, normally when I'm reading a series, I love the first book more because it sets up the world. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But in this one, or like in this movie, I like the last one because it really did the setup because it was the past, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I actually, 1666 was the one that I liked the best as well. But I liked that they explored different horror genres in each of the three movies, like camp 90s slasher in 1994. They have like the 80s slasher movie vibe with 1978. And then they have a period horror with 1666. And they use like a lot of different tropes and lighting schemes and music to kind of enhance all of those. And I really enjoyed that about the three movies.
I really love that you say all those things because I'm certain that they are things that I enjoyed but had no words to describe.
In horror especially, there's really poor queer representation. Bury Your Gaze is very prominent, and the gays that you're burying are not main characters. And then other characters that are gay or queer-coded are usually monsters or villains. And there's a place for that in horror, I think, because it does come from this feeling of ostracization from the world. And there's a reason that queer people connect to them. Monsters and villains and see them as queer-coded. So, like, I don't want to diminish that for people that have those connections through the history of horror, but I think it's really important to be able to see a queer protagonist and have a lesbian lead for the whole series. Change the name. It's also important, I guess we should say, that Dina is biracial in the movies as well, and her brother Josh, you know, is Black, and that's important. As two of the protagonists in the movie as well.
Oh my God, you're right. Josh and Dina live. Like, oh my God. Like, I thought about the gay, but I like missed beyond my watching and being like, oh, hey, we got POC. Like, beyond that, I didn't think about like, oh my God, the POC lived.
I watched some interviews or listened to interviews with the director, Lee Janiak, who wrote the movies, and her co-writer, Phil Grazia-Day. And Phil is gay, and I think that is important to take into account in how these movies were structured and written. One of the main themes of the trilogy is the idea of history repeating itself. Queer history is also passed down through generations, because much of our history couldn't be written down through 1666 through 1994, and how Sarah and Hannah parallel Sam and Dina. And Phil was talking about in an interview how a lot of mainstream movies that are queer, their main character feels straight in a way and safe, if that makes sense. They're much more palatable to an audience. And so I think I could see clearly in these movies, as this is a mainstream story and written to be a mainstream story about a lesbian, they were very intentional in making Dina feel like a lesbian, I guess, and not just be like kind of a straight passing character that's palatable to people. And they make their kind of relationship very important throughout the whole story of the trilogy, where you can't deny it and can't shy away from it. Does that make sense?
I hadn't really considered my brain goes to generational trauma. And my brain hadn't really thought about how not only is it just kind of like an interesting story and like ancestry, because I really liked it kind of like historically, because I really like history and stuff. But thinking about generational trauma and thinking about the repetitions of we see the same kind of cycles and kind of getting caught up in perpetuating our own demise, you know, this kind of like self-sabotaging, this like belief of who we are and what we are, and just making and having that happen again, but specifically around queer history not being able to be documented. I hadn't thought about that. And I think that that's really interesting because Sarah is the only one who knows her truth and her story
And
and
she's
what that means.
villainized.
Yeah. And I know we'll get into it more in 1666, but you know, that I think throwing in the what this means in the real world of queer history being able to be shared and passed down, I think adds another layer that I hadn't really considered to this. With regards to the representation or depiction of the protagonist as queer, I don't know how strongly I feel about that. I mean, I definitely can believe that Dina is queer, like or lesbian from like her attire and demeanor and kind of attitude and things like that. But at the end of the day, Sam and Dina are still feminine women. I mean, they've got long hair, they wear clothing that's like it's not really one way or the other. Like it's just like what I imagine teenagers wear. So I don't really have strong feelings about their representation, like how they were presented aesthetically. But again, I didn't come out until I was much older, so I have no idea what it's like to be a gay teen.
Choosing Dina to be the protagonist versus Sam is kind of important. She is kind of angry, I guess, in a way. Like, she's not really palatable for men, if that makes sense, even though she's very attractive.
Yes, that is accurate. I would say that she is not palatable for men, and she does not attempt to be. She does not want to be. She does not care to be. And I love her for it.
I think like people that have problems with her when a protagonist are because of that. Like, she's not meant to be palatable in a traditional way. I just would like to say what I really enjoyed about 1994 is like how referential these movies were. There is a major homage to Scream in the beginning, where Maya Hawke is killed in the first like 5 minutes of the movie, and you wouldn't expect Maya Hawke to get killed in the first 5 minutes of the movie because she is probably one of the most famous people in the movie. But the history of that, if you don't know, is that Drew Barrymore was the most famous person in Scream when it came out. It was like all over the promotion, and she was killed within the first 5 minutes of that movie.
Yeah, it gave me, it did. It gave me a lot of Scream vibes. And I think that's what made it palatable for me at first. 'Cause I was like, this feels familiar to me. Like this feels like something I'm familiar with. And there's just like something about, like, I can't put my finger on it. Like, 'cause I just like, I don't know these terms. I don't care enough to figure it out. But there's just like something about the way that it was filmed at the beginning that wasn't scary in the way that I hate horror movies. And I found almost just really like visually appealing, despite the fact that it was murder.
So we get introduced to our protagonist, Dina, as she writes a hate you letter to her ex, Sam. They're really building it up because I never use any pronouns for Sam until we see her on screen for the first time. And like when Dina's being all angsty in school, she's seeing a bunch of straight couples make out and being like upset. You know, like they're really building the audience up to be shocked that Sam's a girl. And here we're kind of introduced to our main characters throughout the movie. So we have Dina, the kind of angsty, broody teen protagonist. Josh, who's kind of like the historian that keeps the story going and keeps you tied to the lore of the story. Sam, who's the damsel character in a horror. Simon, the lovable comic relief, and Kate, the spunky best friend. So we're kind of all introduced to these characters as we pick up. And we have this idea planted that Seraphira is cursing the town. The town of Shadyside has just become accustomed and used to bad things happening. So it's not like everybody believes it's because of the curse of Seraphira. And then one of my favorite things, which I feel is deeply connected to our podcast, is when Dina tells Josh like to get off doing his internet bullshit. And he's like, it's not bullshit. It's a community dedicated to the truth.
Yeah, I think I don't remember what Dina said specifically, but it was basically like these people like aren't your friends, like they're strangers on the internet, like go out and like live your life. And I was just like, internet friends are real friends.
I have an embarrassing thing to admit.
Uh-huh.
It took me like 10 years to figure out that Simon's face was painted green because he was the mascot.
I don't even remember when his face was painted green.
It's in this front thing with like the band and the cheerleaders and stuff. He's supposed to be the witch.
Oh, yeah, I do remember.
It's the mascot. And like while I was watching it, I was like, why is he there? Why is his face painted green? He's just like going along because he's their friend and he's like goofing around. Like, I literally could not put together that he was the mascot for so long. It's embarrassing how long it took me to figure that out. But we see Dina waiting with Sam's box, and we see Sam show up.
I did think that I guess maybe like appropriate for teenagers, although I find that I was not a normal teenager, that they're just like angsty. And it's just like, you broke up with me. You moved away. It was like my parents' divorce. It's 30 minutes away. Might as well be like forever. I'm like, dude, fucking lesbians date each other like that. I know it's 94, but I'm like, 30 minutes is not that fucking far away.
It's a lot different when you break up and you're the only out gay person in 1994 than when you break up with somebody now.
I really think that like I just did not have a normal teenage experience. So like I just really can't relate.
Kind of fucked up by mentioning 30 minutes because the lesbian experience is like, I'll date someone clear across the country, I'll date someone in another country on another continent.
If you're the only fucking gay around, like why are you like why did you break up with her?
It's more of a big deal that she moved to Sunnyvale.
Yeah, definitely. That is true. I mean, because Sam is going to the place where everyone succeeds while Dina is stuck in shitty, shady side.
As they're leaving, there's a car chasing the bus, and it turns out Sam is in the car, and Dina wants revenge on Peter and Sam, and so she tries to throw a cooler on the car, and she starts to realize that's a bad idea, but she gets a nosebleed and does it anyway, and the car crashes.
I think she was just trying to throw the liquid content. I think with a nosebleed, she lost control. And I realized that most of my contributions are just going to be questions because my question was, why did her nose bleed? I don't.
Listen, this is the question I have. Why do only certain women get nosebleeds in their bones?
Sam, she touched the body. Ziggy touched the body. Alice touched the hand. You know? So why Dina? When she wasn't touching
No,
anything.
see, they get the nosebleed before they touch it. They get it when they're near it. I don't, it doesn't make sense to me necessarily why Dina gets it still. Maybe it's because Dina's an ancestor of Seraphir. So, like,
But she's not.
I mean, I don't think she is either, but that's the best I can come up with.
Okay, because I had a question about her ancestry, but okay, anyways, let's go.
So, yeah, Sam gets real fucked up. And I just have to say that even here, you kind of get the vibe that the cop is not good. And it's appropriate in modern times that the cop starts to appear as the villain, so appreciate that.
At least he gives off very like condescending asshole vibes, if nothing else.
When Dina's calling around trying to check up on Sam and see how she is, she like breaks a drumstick, and that is what Sam stabs her with later. So good on them for that continuity.
Yeah, I like that. Because I definitely thought about it when she broke it. I was like, that is dangerous. Why are you leaving it? And this was before I even realized, you know, what was going to happen. Maybe it's just because I'm accident prone. And I was just like, danger, danger.
Danger zone. Danger zone. And then, of course, Sam's mom is very, like, hateful towards Dina and says that she's trying to ruin her life. So
clearly knows there's something going on with the two of them.
Dina, Kate, and Simon have run-ins with a creepy guy in a skeleton mask that they think is Peter harassing them. So they go to the hospital to yell at Sam about her boyfriend. And they get to her through Kate's drug dealer, Betty.
Nurse Betty, yes. I was actually really intrigued by the drug stuff. I was just like, God, in the 90s? Were perks and benzos, like, really a thing? When as a kid, I don't know.
I don't know. I know a lot about 90s drug culture from my sister, but that's more like the rave ecstasy scene, so I don't know much about the over-the-counter situation back then. Sam is pretty exasperated because Dina's trying to accuse her of coming after them, and she's been in the hospital this whole time.
Honestly, this is where I'm just like, I fucking hate Sam. She is an awful human being. Why the fuck do I care about her?
I don't feel that way. Definitely.
Yeah, this is where I was like, I know we're going to disagree with each other. It's like, I fucking hated her here. I'm just like, she fucking tells Dina that she put her in the hospital. No, motherfucker, your stupid little shitty ass boyfriend went after this bus and decided to be a dick. So it's his own fucking fault for getting in that car accident. Also, when she said to Dina that she was going to wake up like her father, like an alcoholic going nowhere, I was like, damn, bitch, you sure know the buttons to push and you're pushing them. Like, that, how you hurt someone that you say you've loved, I do not understand. Like, that, I get being mean, I get being rude, but that's too fucking far, man. Like, no, I'm not okay with her. So, did not care for Sam.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. That feels very true to what a teenager would say, in my opinion, in a fight. So I kind of get, like, you're up in the hospital, your ex-girlfriend threw something on the car that you were in, whether your boyfriend was wrong or not, like, what Dina did is not okay either.
An accident.
You know, it's a pretty dangerous thing to do to somebody. So, like, I get being pretty exasperated, especially because from her perspective, like, her boyfriend has been there with her all night. So it's like Dina's just coming in and starting shit when you're, like, in the hospital, probably have a concussion, you know, like, a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So I could get why she's pretty frustrated. Do I think what she says itself is, like, okay? No. But I could get why Sam says what she says, I guess. I don't know. It didn't bother me, like, at all. So,
I don't think that it bothers most people because I see everyone loving Sam. And I gotta say, I never do. I hate her throughout.
Yeah, a lot of people, actually a lot of straight people hate Sam.
Definitely not straight. I just really hate her.
While they're yelling at each other, Peter gets stabbed and dies, and I live for that because I like that the boyfriend is immediately irrelevant and he's the first major kill of the movie. The guy seems to be, like, clearly after Sam in the hospital. He runs right by Kate and Josh and Simon. I, like, questioned it the first time I watched it, but I didn't think too much about it. It took me a long time to put that together. Did you notice that instantly?
I mean, like, I knew that he went right past, but, like, I didn't really think about why. You know, because I wasn't thinking, like, oh, well, this is the thing that, like, kills everyone, like, in sight. Like, I didn't really understand the pattern to who it chose to kill, you know?
But this leads them to trying to report it to the cops who don't give a fuck.
Nick Good is such a dick. Like, he's just like, you know, so, like, was this, like, a zombie? Like, he is just such an ass. Like, he just really keeps racking up, like, these, like, awful person points for someone who's supposed to, you know, be a helper.
And then them having to put things together on their own. And, of course, our main man, Josh, puts all the clues together, realizes that their previous killers are coming back to life and going after them. Sam and Dina have a little moment where they're trying to figure out what is going on with them and what is going on with people trying to kill them at the same time. Just your typical teenage angst, you know what I'm saying?
The only thought I have is why give her your sweater you like so much? She's fucking bleeding and you're trying to evade death. Like, I just.
Well, she is wearing Peter's sweater, so I would probably want to give her my sweater too. Be like, take that fucking sweater off.
Nah, bitch, you fucking protected your man. You could stay in his shit.
I think Dina is more sympathetic to the idea that Sam is really beholden to this heteronormativity, even though she's a lesbian, and she tells her that it's not easy for her to be like us either.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, Dina definitely understands, and is in love with her, so she, can overlook shit that I cannot.
But because we don't really get to know much about what they were like together, I think that's where some of this comes in that you have trouble buying into because you don't know the Sam before this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was gonna say this at the end of the movie, but I guess I'll say it now. I don't know why people like Sam and Dina. Like, I don't. Like, there's not enough backstory on them for me. Like, I don't know who they were as a couple. I don't know what they were like when they were together. All I see is like their breakup. Like, I see Dina being upset. I see Sam being a bitch. I get it, they're teenagers, but like, and I see that they want to be with each other, but like at the end of the day, I don't know why I care about them because I had no build up to them. You just thrust me into the end of their relationship. I don't care about them.
I thought they had a lot of chemistry, which helped me invest in them. And I felt like if we had a little bit more of like the context of them as people in their relationship apart from that breakup, then the people that had issues with them would be more invested in them.
Oh, absolutely. I can totally love people who are totally fucked up and shitty and are awful towards each other, but I need the build, like I need the buy-in, and they didn't give me any buy-in. Like I have nothing from, and I get it, like we're setting up the movie, like that's not really where the story is like focused on, but without that, I could not buy into them.
So then we figure out that this is tied to the witch, and Sam saw the witch, and they find out that she's disturbed the grave, and they try to undisturb it, but nothing can be that simple, and someone still tries to kill them. And this is the first time where Dina saves Sam's life because she literally would have died if she didn't pull her out of there. They kind of find out from this experience that they're not going after all of them, they're going after Sam. It becomes clear that they're going to use Sam as bait to try to kill all of our murderous zombies.
Yeah, they're gonna jaws this shit.
So they go to the school and they have to decontaminate and make sure there is no blood on them. Then we have a classic horror movie trope where everybody hooks up before the climax to release some tension and make everybody feel really good and invested before everything goes to shit.
Is that a classic horror movie thing? Because I was just like, why the fuck are you trying to fuck when you're about to fucking die?
Yeah, it feels very like traditional in horror movies. Like, there's usually some sort of like moment like this, I feel like.
Oh my God, no. You see, I'm too based in reality. Like, I just am. So, like, I was annoyed by this. I was just like, you dumb fucks. Like, I just couldn't.
But I also think that is a part of horror movies. Like you're yelling at them constantly for doing something really stupid, like when they
Oh,
shouldn't be
yes,
doing
I can
that.
accept that.
But there's kind of a moment here between Sam and Dina with their shirts off, which is, classic, where they're kind of like talking a little bit about their experiences, and Sam kind of feels like all of this is her fault because she ran away from her relationship with Dina because she was scared of it and she was scared of herself. And she finally feels like herself when she's with Dina.
You see, I feel like that's supposed to be an important line, poignant, like feeling like you can be you with this other person. But again, with the lack of like my understanding of them as people and like their background, like it didn't land for me. It didn't land for me. I was like, oh, what pretty words that mean nothing.
They have their sex scene, and I liked how it played out in the context of the movie. Like, I felt it was pretty like sexy and tasteful, and I liked kind of the idea of like how it plays into the whole like Sam's internal battle and how it kind of reinforces Sam's queerness before they kind of hit the main kind of climax of the movie.
I thought it was shot well.
It's kind of important for Sam's identity to like establish her identity as we move forward. And her like taking this like next step and accepting herself.
Okay.
Which I know you don't, because you didn't give a fuck about Sam,
Yeah, I don't feel it, but okay.
but as someone that does like her and like what they're doing with that character, I liked that it felt necessary and wasn't, it didn't feel gratuitous to me.
Oh, that's hilarious. It only felt gratuitous to me.
And so they go from this to trying to trick all of the killers into a room to burn them alive. And let me just say, this is a pet peeve of mine. Why are you cutting across your hand with a giant ass cut that's going to take forever to heal?
Where would you cut yourself to get the most blood, Katie?
Not my fucking hand, that is for sure. Of course, they trap them, burn them alive. It doesn't work. They come back to life.
In the most disgusting way possible. Like all of their little chunks just start coming back together.
But so, as they're kind of facing all of this and they're being like brought closer together and finding comfort in each other to survive, I think it builds the stakes and explains more why Dina has a hard time. This like whole Sam sacrificial thing because she's kind of relying on her to help her face the traumatic events. We have a whole discussion here because of coming back to life about how the only option is to sacrifice Sam, and Kate is the one who says to sacrifice Sam, and that's why she's the first one to die, and I knew instantly she was going to die the second she did that.
Look, I'm the Kate. I'm the Kate.
See, that's the thing. I know you're the Kate, and I knew you would feel this way, and I'm not like that at all. I literally would never let any of my friends do that.
I don't know that I would follow through, but it's true. I'm just a logical person that way. It's true. She is the one that they are after. If she dies, everyone else is safe. One life for so many. Like it makes sense. Now, would I do it? No, because I couldn't do that to another human being, but I would think that I'm making a dumb choice in the grand scheme of things. Absolutely. Like, Kate's right.
I think it's pretty like fucked up to sacrifice your friend. So
I mean, they're not friends. They didn't care. She didn't care about her.
that's what's unclear because I really wonder if they were friends at some point or not. Because I
Not
think they
very
go
good
back
friends if
and
she was
forth.
gonna sacrifice her.
Dina really fights it, but Sam agrees and goes out to sacrifice herself.
That is the part that makes me not hate her as much. I'm like, oh, good, you have some care for other people. Like that's the one thing. And I was just like, all right, maybe she ain't all bad.
Just as she's about to be clobbered, Josh saves the day and figures out there might be another way. And they come to the conclusion that Sam needs to die. And they're going to kill her and bring her back to life.
Yep, a la who? Timothy? Is that the brother's name?
They basically decide that she's going to OD and take 1,000 pills.
Oh my God, I could not believe how many fucking pills she had to take. I was like, Jesus Christ.
Like, it was a lot. And then
What
they're going to bring her
is
back
the
with EpiPens. A lot of people left the movie feeling like Kate and Simon should have lived and Sam should have just died because they liked Kate and Simon more than Sam, which I get in terms of liking characters. However, you're also missing the whole context of the movie if Sam dies because then you don't end the curse, number one. And also, I think the audience plays into that classic horror trope and they automatically view her as expendable because they've been trained to do so in horror movies because the gay characters are expendable.
I think that if any, because I didn't, you know, see this stuff, but I think that if anyone holds that belief that like Sam should have just died, I think, yeah, misses the entire point. And I could see how that would be in some way based on the fact that queer characters tend to be expendable. It makes no sense for her to die. While I wanted Kate and Simon to live, I don't think that I ever wanted Sam to die. I didn't think it made sense for her to die.
And then Sam also gives them an out here and says, like, you don't have to do this. You can leave. And Kate and Simon as individuals make a clear decision not to leave her. So I think it's a little bit unwarranted, some of the hate that Sam gets in relation to Simon and Kate dying.
Yeah, I felt I was really upset that they died because they chose to stay. And I was just like, these motherfuckers are going to die for this damn girl. Like, they should have just gone home. They should have just gone home.
And that's the thing where I was talking about with their relationships, where it goes back and forth on whether you're supposed to feel like Sam was a part of this group or not. Because if she was, then I kind of understand why they died for her. But if she wasn't, then it's harder to understand. You know what I mean?
The only person I'm dying for is my mom and my wife. That's it.
That's a lot of people I'd probably die for. In terms of my friend circle. So it's just
how that goes. Oh, fuck no. I love y'all, but I love me more. Bye.
Dina gives a nice little speech to try to encourage her to overdose and says that we're going to get through this. I'm going to take you on a date. We're going to get cheeseburgers and listen to the Pixies. And she promises that she will bring her back. And then Sam just knocks down this big pile of pills like they're Tic Tacs. I'm like, all right, you just do that.
Then it was also really hard for me when Dina has to give Sam the next round of pills and like having to shove. Like, that sucks. Like having to like hurt the person you love for the greater
also,
good.
Literally, what is going on here? You're in a grocery store. Like, get some water.
Get some water to wash that shit down.
Wash it down. Who can do that? But the killers arrive and they're going after people. And in the flurry, the pills go everywhere. And there's kind of levels of camp horror that I really like. Like Sam just like saying over and over again, like, I need to die. Like part of that is just like kind of funny and horrific at the same time. And I like those elements. And so they decide to drown Sam. And while this is happening, Kate goes through a bread slicer and Simon gets an axe to the head.
I was so dumb. I was just like, why is she staring at the lobster? I didn't gather that it was drowning.
Literally, so many people are like, a lobster. And I don't know what I thought, but I think I thought she was going to drown her. So.
I mean, makes sense. I just really didn't. I was like, does a lobster hold the answers? Like, I just didn't get it.
Like, people are like, is she allergic to shellfish? Like, what's going to happen?
That would have been hilarious.
I also think, like, there is an important moment, like you were saying, like, with how, like, Dina's having to shove the pills down her throat, where, like, Dina looks at Sam before she drowns her, and Sam, like, has to tell her to do it, because there's like a difference between Sam ODing herself and Dina having to kill Sam and drown her, because there's no guarantee that she can bring her back, and then she would have to live with the fact that she killed her herself.
Yeah, that was so intense. I honestly don't know if I could do that. Like, I just really don't know that I could do that.
So Sam dies, and then this is the part that drove me the most crazy about the whole movie, is when she dies, Dina stabs about 100 EpiPens in her, and I'm just like screaming at her, like, she drowned, what the fuck are you doing stabbing her with a bunch of EpiPens?
Yeah, I thought the same thing, and then I also was just like, how much adrenaline is too much adrenaline?
I was literally thinking that. I was like, is Sam going to be okay when she comes back? Like, I know she's technically dead, so how much does that adrenaline affect the body? Because that's a lot of fucking adrenaline that she has.
Yeah, see, too realistic. But you know what? She comes back. She's alive. She pukes. It's all good.
She's all good. And then the murders get pinned on Kate and Simon. Dina's kind of clearly upset that it's getting pinned on them and defends kind of their importance in the world and who they were, despite it being a fucked up situation. And so does Josh as well. I just thought it was very clear that she cared a lot about them, but what is she going to do once they're already dead and they're alive? I don't know.
Yeah. When she describes them, it felt for me as if though she's accepting the fucked up way that it's going to get spun, because that's just it, that's what's going to happen. But in saying it, she's also pointing out how they were a product of circumstances and it wasn't all bad, you know, like a boy who's taking care of his family since he was like however old, and a girl who is trying to make it out of here. Like, I liked what she said.
And then we have Sam and Dina leaving the police station, and Sam's mom shows up when they're leaving and is very upset about Sam being with Dina. And then there's a little fake out moment where you think Sam might ditch Dina after everything they've been through, but Sam kisses her in front of her mom and says she'll see her later tonight.
Yes, I appreciated Sam getting the nerve to, you know, do that. I think that that was big.
And I think it's important if you're going to continue on in this relationship that Sam does make like that gesture, which is part of their original falling out. And then we jump to Dina's house later, where Dina gives Sam the mixtape and the note that says, "I love you and I always will," below several scratched out sayings about how she hates Sam. But, you know, who needs to write a new letter when you can show her the whole history? "Hey" by the Pixie Place, but there's a clue in it where it says, like, "There must be a devil between us" as they're cuddling together. So they're telling you, like, basically something else. And then we basically find out it's not over because Sam's name gets written on the wall and she's possessed and she stabs Dina.
Wait, but they don't show her name written on the wall, do they, in 94?
Yes, they do.
Oh, well, fuck, I missed that both times. And that's why I was like, what the fuck happened to Sam? I was so confused until the very end.
Yeah, they say, like, it's not over until she says it is, and they think it's the witch, like, cursing Sam. But really, what I think is important is when Nick is interviewing Sam, I think he has an idea that Sam and Dina know more about what's going on than he wants them to, and that's why he offers Sam up.
That would make sense, because I was just like, why did he do that to her?
But yeah, that's how the movie ends. The next movie is 1978, and we're not going to really dive into it in depth because it's not explicitly queer, but I did want to just touch on the movie as part of the trilogy. It's really based on, like, classic slashers of that time period and the setting and the colors, and I really enjoyed those elements of it, and I also really enjoy kind of this, like, camp horror. And I really liked the sister relationship in it between Cindy and Ziggy. And then, of course, there's a lot of, like, queer subtext with Alice and Cindy that a lot of people latched onto and really liked about the movie.
I did see that that was a thing. I mean, I guess I could see it. I didn't really look for it.
It's interesting when given explicitly queer content that a lot of people still latch on to subtext as opposed to the explicit queerness, like, with an example being, like, Supergirl, you know what I mean?
Yep.
You can project what you want onto subtext, and that's why a lot of people like it. That's the only thing I can come up with, because I've really wondered about that myself.
I think it's just there's more tension. I think that people like the build-up to a thing more so than the thing itself. And so when it's non-canon, it's just a lot
of... The build-up lasts forever.
Yeah, because you never get the gratification.
Alice and Cindy's relationship, in a way, is pretty universal and true to a lot of people that have, like, a really tight relationship when they're younger. And then as they grow up, they have kind of these intense falling outs as you kind of become your own person and stuff like that. So I think it's something that's very easy for people to relate to and latch on to. I kind of liked that in an explicitly queer movie trilogy, there was a kind of a subtextual relationship between Alice and Cindy, because I kind of feel like it's honoring the subtext that queer fans have latched onto all along in their, like, horror consumption, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's intentional, but that's just kind of, like, the reading that I get from it that I liked.
I think that that would be nice if that was the intent.
Okay, so now we're going to go to 1666, which is the period horror setting, which I like. One of my favorite, I don't know what this says about me, but one of my favorite movies is The Crucible. So this is always going to be like down my lane of something that I liked. And I knew going into it, I was going to really like it just because of that.
That's funny. I'm pretty sure I messaged you and said I got the Crucible vibes from the Crucible / Scarlet Letter vibes from Nick Good.
I liked a lot about it. Like, I liked the setting and the music and how they were like really playing into this period horror. But I was really on the fact that they did accents because they executed it to varying levels of success.
I wish that they would have just spoken the like normally, like how they do now, or that they would have done it like for the first sentence and then have it drop away as did we kind of like get like immersed into the, like, I just wish they wouldn't have kept it.
But I think it's interesting that they did keep the same characters. Like 1666 and 1994 are clearly supposed to run parallel, and you're supposed to make connections between their opposite characters in each movie. It establishes a stronger emotional connection to the 1666 characters without having to do as much work because you're already attached to those people, if that makes sense. So for a slightly shortened story that 1666 is, to execute the lore that's built up through all of the movies, I think that was a pretty smart decision.
I agree. And I think that's why I like 1666 more, is because I've already built up how I feel about Dina, which transfers to how I feel about Sarah before their story even starts.
We're introduced to all of our familiar faces. And then we have Sarah running into Hannah Miller. And there's clearly romantic chemistry from them, between them from the beginning. Hannah's the pastor's daughter. Sarah's established kind of as this clearly pretty independent and bold woman from that time period already. And I think their chemistry really shines for the context of this time period and what we know about them.
Yeah, I thought it was clear that they've got something going on. I don't know if it was the accents or the faces. I didn't really love the way that they played it. But I could tell that there was, you know, something there. And Mama knows, too, because of the way Sarah jumps back from Hannah.
And then they go to see the Widow to get their drug berries. And the Widow has a legacy of witchcraft, which is important to know. And when they see the Widow, Sarah finds the devil book, and then she gets chased out when they're discovered.
But don't worry, Kate's ancestor made sure to get the berries.
She's got the drug hookup in any century. So they take their berry drugs and let loose around the fire.
I'm just thinking about, like, the family business. It all began in 1666 with the drug berries.
And ended up with some Percocets. And I just thought the scene was, like, cute and funny when they're, like, dancing around and, like, locking eyes across the fire all high on drugs.
It gave me Portrait of a Lady on Fire vibes.
And I'm going to expose myself and say I haven't seen that movie still. Anyway, then Caleb, formerly known as Peter, tries to go after Hannah.
Oh my God, is that who Caleb was Peter? Yeah. I could not remember who his fucking face was. Like, the men, their faces all meld together in my head.
And then Sarah publicly humiliates him, which obviously is going to have repercussions in that time period for these fragile men. And then they have a moment on the rock, which feels like the first time they've acted on their feelings for each other based off the conversation. And I think it's an interesting parallel to 94 because Sarah's the one that initially pulls back and says this is wrong, and Hannah's the one that says it doesn't feel wrong.
Okay. I don't know what I thought about that in like comparison to 94. I did think that it was just interesting that the pastor's daughter was the one who felt so confident and secure in pursuing this. And I thought I was definitely like, "Oh, hot damn." Like this scene, like, okay, we're just really
We're just gonna
really
have
doing it.
some lesbian sex in the 1600s and go for it. Let's do
Yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, right out there in the middle of the woods. Where else would you act on those
That's
feelings?
all you got. Yep.
And then what's important here is where the red moss comes through in the trilogy. So it's something between Hannah and Sarah. And then they hear someone in the woods and they run off because in the 1600s, that's probably pretty terrifying. So they run off and they discuss what being caught means and how they'll be hanged. And Sarah says, "Let them hang us then. I was not alive now before, alive before now anyway." And they kiss. Mad Thomas catches them. And I'm like, why in the middle of town would you do that when you were literally just caught in the woods?
I know, I did wonder the same thing. I was like, oh my God, you're being so reckless. And then, like, I know when we were talking about 94, you're talking about like people viewing it from a modern context rather than the 90s. And so I definitely found myself viewing this in a modern context where I was just like, why are you worried about people catching you? Like, it's your word against theirs, but I just kind of forgot that they're women. So, like, yeah.
So then we have the next day after this moment. Hannah comes to see Sarah and says her dad is acting weird. And Hannah starts to wonder if their wickedness caused it. And her mom doesn't want them to see each other anymore because Mad Thomas saw them and they suspect that something's going on between them.
Okay, I just have to say, like, really, we're gonna believe Mad Thomas the drunkard? Like, still though, like, I was just like, come on, girls, take your shot. Like, say, like, nah, he drunk.
But of course, a man's word is going to be believed over a woman's, even if he is a town drunk.
When do they mention that Berman she hooked up with Thomas? I was just like, really, really, Mad Thomas? Come on, girl, you could have hooked up with someone else.
Mad Thomas, I can't really buy into that. I'm sorry. But you know what? Who am I to judge what a girl has to do in the 1600s? I don't know. It's interesting what they decide to do clear parallels for. But Sam's mom comes, or Sam's mom, Hannah's mom comes back and says something about how, like, Sarah will ruin her life. And that's almost exactly the same thing that Sam's mom says to Dina. So even though we're viewing different characters with Sarah and Hannah and Sam and Dina, there's meant to be like clear parallels and connections between the two sets of characters, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was just like so very much like what happened in 94.
And Sarah's dad thinks that because she was raised like a boy without a mother. And I'm like, this is one of the ones where I'm like, I really had to remind myself of the time period and context because it's like, fuck you. But I think it's important because it's meant to establish why Sarah is also going to continue the curse against Nick because she has always been different anyway, and it's really easy to persecute people that are different. How she's got this kind of like personal resolve that wasn't seen in many women of the time.
Yeah, and I think that it's a pretty standard explanation. I mean, even to this day, I feel like people like, why are you gay? What man hurt you? You know? Like, it's just trying to find an explanation for a thing you don't understand.
And that, like, you know, if you're interested in anything that's not explicitly feminine, that you're gay, which I mean, it's true sometimes, but not always. One doesn't necessarily mean the other, okay? It just is what it is. But the town goes rotten, essentially. All the food goes bad. Their well is ruined. Their crops are dying. The town is clearly cursed overnight. And this is really in line with how Puritans thought. So, of course, they think that it's the devil. It's interesting that they're really starting to build in this idea of a strangeness in Sarah, and they're trying to build you into like really believing that she is the witch and becomes the witch, but really she's just gay. She's just a tragic gay. And then Sarah confesses to Solomon about Hannah, and she wonders if something's wrong with her. Maybe the devil is within her. And this is, I think, really an explicit parallel to internalized homophobia here, and how queer characters are so often the villains in horror. And so they're kind of recognizing that and like flipping that on its head. And I appreciated that here. And about how what society, like sometimes people become what society wants them to be because they're so contained and confined, and it's hard to find your way out of it. And then, Solomon tries to blow it off and say that, it's just a dalliance. It's okay. And Sarah's like, it's not just a dalliance. And still, Solomon is very supportive of her here and says that one cannot summon the devil by chance and acts very supportive of her. I was suspicious with him from the beginning here because I was like, this doesn't add up. He's just okay with this. I don't buy it. Number one. And number two, it's, I guess, clear that he did this because he knows it's his fucking fault and he didn't want her to blame herself.
I don't know if I had already suspected him at this point. I mean, probably because he's a good, but I just appreciated his saying that to her because Sarah, like, is tr like she truly believes that she has brought the devil in, and so for him to say like you have to extend your hand, I think was just really reassuring to her, and I appreciated it regardless of, intention or motivation.
And then we come to the pastor slaying the children in the chapel and cutting their eyes out. And this is a very creepy period horror sequence here. And I just liked the horror elements of it and how it was visually executed. And then, of course, it couldn't just be that the pastor lost his mind and killed everybody. There must be a witch behind it because a man would never do this.
Yeah, the pastor's super faithful. What's the word that I'm looking for? He's just a religious dude. Of course not. It must be a witch who's done this to him.
Caleb, the ever fragile man, decides to get his payback and says that it was Hannah and Sarah. And then all of the other men on the town in the town just jump on board for a scapegoat just because they want to persecute somebody. And Hannah and Sarah try to run and hide, but Hannah trips and is caught, and Sarah gets away. And then, for the lovely time period it is, Hannah's raped and tortured, which is luckily only implied, and we don't have to really see any of it.
Oh, do you think that she was? I mean, I guess they were checking her for a mark. I didn't go so far as to think that she was raped. I mean, touched inappropriately, but
Well, that's the same thing to me.
oh, I would distinguish between the two, but
I would say that she was sexually assaulted.
yeah, I would say she's sexually assaulted, absolutely. What I was gonna say is I am livid with Kayla because like this is like what 1666 like just brought up so much of my hate for men. It's just like, motherfucking Caleb didn't get some, so he's like, y'all bitches will die. Like, fuck you, Caleb, you piece of shit.
There's a difference between being mad at someone and doing something that's gonna get them killed. Accusing them of witchcraft is literally gonna get them killed. Like, oh my fucking God.
Literal death sentence, yeah.
And so as the witch hunt continues for Sarah sneaks back to find Hannah, who's been clearly beaten to hell and back. And Hannah begs Sarah to run because she's supposed to hang the next day. And Hannah thinks that this is her fault, for opening up to the devil. Sarah tries to reassure her that it's not her fault. And Hannah says, it doesn't matter what we've done, they think we're guilty, so we are. And then Sarah says that then she will make a deal with the devil. And she says she does not fear the devil. She fears the neighbor that would accuse her. And she fears the mother that would let her daughter hang. She fears the union. They lead us like lambs to a slaughter, but I am no lamb. And then she says, you know, if they want a witch, I'll give them a witch.
I absolutely love everything about this.
It's one of my favorite. It's the execute. It's also how Kiana, the actress, like delivers it.
Oh, she's great.
She's great here. It is one of my favorite moments in the whole trilogy, this scene.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I love strong, badass women. I love fuck the system. Like, fuck you all. You want a witch? I'll give you a fucking witch. I love it. I just really appreciated the line where it's like, I don't fear the devil, I fear the neighbor, because we're so scared of the scary things that go bump in the night. And really the huge horror is your neighbor down the street who's a Donald supporter. The fear is the neighbor down the street who's a fucking racist. You know, what's really scary is human beings.
It is people that you're afraid of, that you don't know who they are and what they're capable of. It's not necessarily what's in the dark, you know? Here, too, there's a promise of, like, a happy future between them where they can dance every night and kiss in the broad daylight. It all just feels very tragic here because you know when she says this that they're not going to get it. In comparison to the conversation that Sam and Dina have, where you don't know for sure that they will get it or not, but you have hope that they will. Versus here, like, you don't even have hope because you know it's not going to happen. After Dina's promise to give them a witch, she tries to go find the Witta, but the Witta has been slaughtered. And so she runs to find Solomon. And the second she ran to find Solomon is where I figured out that it was him. But it did take me until, like, right here. I figured it out before Sarah did, but not much before she did.
I feel pretty similarly. I didn't feel good about the goods the entire time, but I didn't understand the severity. Like, I didn't realize, like, what exactly it meant until then.
Yeah. It's like you knew there was something there, but I couldn't put together all the pieces of, like, the history in all the movies yet. But, I guess there's, like, this layer, like, he targeted the pastor because he saw Sarah and Hannah together and he's in love with Sarah.
Is that why? I was like, why did he go after the pastor? I just thought he went after him because he was, like, religious and he'd be the most likely person to try and determine what actually happened.
Which might be part of it, but because they show him being the one that saw Sarah and Hannah, I think that must be part of it.
I think totally possible, yeah.
I think this is a genuinely really good horror sequence where they're kind of confronting each other and Sarah's kind of running away and, like, the fear of man is, like, very palpable.
Before we get into that, so what I want, this is, like, where I wanted to say. So I really appreciated when Sarah finds that it's Solomon who has summoned the devil and he has extended his hand, because as I was watching this, like, before I realized, like, where we were going, I was also scared that Sarah was the reason the devil was in union. And this is, like, why, you know, like, an unintentional witch or something. Like, I was really nervous about that. And so I appreciate what Solomon said. And then when I saw that it was him having extended his hand and intentionally bringing the devil in for his own profit, I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad that they didn't make it so that she had any part in it, even unintentional, because I didn't want the underlying messaging of it being that, yes, being gay is a sin. So I'm like, she had no part in it whatsoever because there is no sin in this.
Right, which is really important in the conversation of, like, queer villains and horror. Like, your inherent queerness is not a villainization, and that is deliberately what this horror movie is telling you, and that's why I think it's really important, and that's why flipping the narrative on Sarah Fear is really important, and it opens this kind of lit up into, like, what you're told versus reality, you know what I mean? And like what I was saying and how queer history is preserved, like just because a bunch of people don't know it doesn't make things true or not. And she's not a villain. She's a tragic hero. And I think that's really important. And so like I was saying, I think this is a really good horror sequence. The fear of man is really palpable. And the scene where her hand gets cut off is legitimately so horrific to me.
That part, like, what further infuriated me was where he's like, stop, I don't want to hurt you. Stop, I don't want to hurt you. And then when she does not stop because he is being scary, he goes to kill her and severs her hand. And, like, it makes me so angry because how many times do men, I think primarily men, do that? Don't make me do this. Don't blah, blah, blah. I love you, blah, blah, blah. Don't you see? And they're the ones who are acting in a terrifying way. You quit your shit, I can quit my shit.
Yeah, really horrific, abusive man stuff going on here. And part of what makes this such a good horror sequence and so tragic is that you're desperately wanting Sarah to get away. And she's such a fighter. She's like wrapping up her cut off arm. She's really like fighting, but you know she's not going to. And then, of course, she does escape, but she escapes right in the middle of Union. And Solomon uses her as a scapegoat and says that he's found the witch. Sarah and Hannah are set to hang, but Sarah decides to confess and save Hannah and says that she bewitched her. And then she threatens Solomon that she will curse them with the truth forever.
I really loved this because I thought it was so beautiful in the sad reality. You know, Sarah is a fighter, and I think that she did a lot, you know, where she's like, they want a witch, I'll give them a witch, you know, blah, blah, blah. But here she is about to hang with Hannah, and she sees the reality of the situation. There is no way for her to get out of this. One of them or both of them will hang for this. And so she uses the only power that she has in that time as a woman. And so she owns that. She says, yes, I am a witch, in order to make the ultimate sacrifice to save her love. And, like, I love this because that is love. Solomon did not love her. His saying, I found the witch in order to preserve what he had sought through the devil, this power, this money, this success, that's not love. And Sarah gives her life because that's love. How beautiful that the real love is with the queer couple, you know? Like,
yeah, and I then, like I was saying, in the context of horror, it feels so important because this character that is typically villainized, like what is typically villainized about her is what makes her so good and so pure, and to have this love that's so like far reaching and so powerful that lasts like kind of centuries almost. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated that. And it's so very sad and tragic, you know, that she does have to sacrifice herself. And for Hannah and all of her friends to have to watch this, knowing the injustice of it all, is really heartbreaking. And the moment where like Hannah and their friends like move her body, like, actually was the most emotional part of all of it for me. I think
the most emotional part for me was when Hannah puts that moss crown on her head when she's buried, and how it blooms, and like how something that had been, because in 1978, I was scared of that moss. Like when she was like, you know, because it was presented in this kind of scary, pervasive, like hard to get rid of, eerie thing. But now we see that it's not something scary. It's something born of love and beautiful. And like, oh my God, the way that they shifted that for me.
Which is also a continued flipping the narrative on like queerness and horror, right? You know, like something that's seen as scary is actually the epitome of pure and love. And I really appreciated that. And I think it's really fucking important that this moss like continues to bloom for centuries. That is this representation of Sarah's devotion to Hannah and their devotion to each other. And I think that there's this idea that even though ignorance is passed between us through generations. Like the legacies of these people before us also matter and are just as strong. And you can also pass through generations this idea of love and acceptance, and, you know, positive things as well.
Yeah, we don't have only have to pass down trauma.
Yeah, so I think that's really important. And I also think this is probably supposed to be a good symbolism in, like, Dina's devotion to Sam throughout all of 1994, in terms of the fact that they're supposed to be representatives of Hannah and Sarah still existing. Oh, so what I think is really cool in the horror aspect, as well as the storytelling aspect of 1666, is the end of the layering of Sarah Fear as Dina in the heroine and protagonist, you know, and the real Sarah Fear is really powerful visually in cementing this concept of generational trauma and how this history is kind of imprinted in all of us and adds like a level of emotional weight on top of the horror and just like the like creepiness factor of it. And so I really liked that from like a storytelling perspective. Okay, so then we jump back into current time, 1994, part two. But basically, we figure out that the curse is passed along through the goods and they have to kill Nick Good. And then we just basically have a lot of fun horror sequences with great visual aesthetics where they're trying to, you know, distract the killers while they go for Nick. Just something I really liked when all of that was going on was the moment that Josh and Dina have with each other before Dina goes after Nick, where Josh goes over like the extra live sequence that he does for himself to have courage and passes it along to Dina. And it was one of the more emotionally resonant moments of the movies for me.
I mean, like, I understand that it's, I understand its intention. I don't think that it had the effect on me, but I understood like what it was meant to do. I liked the headlamp thing. I liked where Josh gave her the headlamp and he said, I know it's nerdy, because in the past he had attempted to give her one. She said no and wouldn't use it. Here she accepted it. And so that meant more to me for some reason. And then I just also like hated Nick because, wow, way to be such a good, because once he sees those people coming after him because he's got blood on him, he grabs on a Ziggy, his supposed love, and says, you know, I die, she dies. So again, you know, like sacrificing the person you supposedly love in order for your own self-preservation, and that's not love.
But basically, to get back to what's important for our purposes, possessed Sam finally escapes out of her confines that you knew was meant to happen at some point, and goes after Dina. And then, you know, Dina is somehow able to trigger something in Sam for a split second to get her out before she, like, knocks her out. And then Dina gets stabbed in the stomach by Nick. And here's the thing. I'm very glad that she reveals a protective shield, because at this point I was like, how many stabs to the stomach can people in these movies survive? Because a bunch of people have gotten stabbed in the stomach. Like, it took one bullet to the stomach to kill Lexa. So, like, what is going on here?
Damn you.
Dina, with the ghost of Sarah Fear, kills Nick Good. She reunites with Sam. They're battered and beaten, bloody, and walk out through Nick Good's pristine, beautiful house in Sunnyvale. And we start to see that now bad things are going to happen in Sunnyvale now that they've broken the curse. And Nick is framed as a serial killer and evil, and all is right in the world.
I mean, what do you mean by framed? He is.
Well, he is, but they don't say he was possessed by the devil, is essentially what I'm saying. They think he's a normal serial killer, not a devil-possessed serial killer.
I also wanted to say that his house is so fucking fancy and nice that I actually thought that they jumped to the future for a second. I was like, are we going to see them happy in the future?
Dina and Sam meet up at Sarah's grave. Dina brings cheeseburgers. The Pixies gigantic plays. We're getting the date that they were promised. And then they also honor Sarah and Hannah's dream date where they're kissing in the broad daylight. So we're getting all of that satisfaction through them.
Surrounded by moss.
And they're surrounded by the beautiful moss of centuries old lesbian love. What more could you ask for? And that is the Fear Street trilogy.
That is the Fear Street trilogy. I am really curious as to how many people are going to hate my contribution to this.
I don't know. Everybody has different opinions. And I think overall, it's really important that a mainstream movie series, just in general, not just in the genre of horror, centered on, you know, a biracial lesbian in her relationship with another lesbian. Like, that's not something that's prominent in mainstream media still. So I think that's important. And so I hope that this means that we keep moving forward and we get to have stories centered on us and surrounding us, and we're not just a part of the table. We're actually like getting to shine in the spotlight.
No, I think that I definitely like what it means for the protagonists to be two lesbians, one of whom is a woman of color. I think it's great that they live, that the story is really about their love. I definitely like agree. Like, maybe if I liked horror movies as a genre, I'd be a lot more forgiving of things, or like I would like it because like I'd understand that like that's a part of it. But this is just isn't my cup of tea. It just really isn't. So honestly, I mean, I like this a lot more than I thought I would. So this is a lot nicer than I expected to be, honestly.
And I think it helps that 1666 was more down your alley of the type of things that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And so that kind of allowed you to have an overall probably better opinion of it, maybe.
Yeah, so I don't regret watching it.
I, as a fan of horror, really liked a lot of all of the elements of all three movies. I like to focus on women. There's a big thing on the final girl and what that means in horror. And it's cool that Dina and Sam are the final girls. It felt like the narratives were driven by women in a positive way in their relationships with each other. I am really hopeful that they do continue on the Fear Street trilogy like series.
Funny how we disagree even in this, because I don't like when things continue. I really don't like that they grabbed the devil journal at the end, because it leaves it open for more. You finished, you wrapped it up. Let's walk away. Like, I don't want you to bring it back to do more, to fuck it up. Cause I feel like that happens a lot. People don't want a thing to end and then they ruin it. And I think that it was like good enough where it was left. And I meant to say this earlier. I mean, I guess I already said it. It was just that, like, I do like Hannah and Sarah. Like, you know, wrapping it up on a gay note, like on a very gay note. Not for me, Sam and Dina. Dina, yes. Not Sam. And I do like Hannah and Sarah.
I like Sam and Dina, and I like Sarah and Hannah. And overall, I really enjoyed it. Whether we get more or not, I think I'm happy either way. And I appreciate having gays in horror. So thanks for that, Lee Janiak. I appreciate it.
I appreciate that for everyone else. Stop doing it. I'm tired of watching gay shit. I mean, horror shit for the gays.
So I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast, and you got to hear us battle it out on our differing opinions. Please let us know what you think and give us your arguments on Twitter at This Lesbian Shit, on Instagram at This Lesbian Ship, and rate, review, download, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thanks. Bye.
This Lesbianship is Intense is a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcast.